Welcome to the Diet Doctor Podcast with Dr. Brett Scher. Today I'm joined by Amber O'Hearn. Now, Amber has become one of the leading personalities of the carnivore movement. And I don't know that she set out to do that. She sort of just came to it by her own health issues. And because of her intellect and her thought process and her very good way of examining things and explaining things, she's really become sort of a go-to person to learn more about this carnivore movement. And it's fascinating because on the one hand, there are all these preconceptions that this shouldn't be, that people shouldn't be living this way, that there are all these risks, but they're mostly theoretical. And we're going to talk a lot about that. Are there any proven risks? What do we need to be careful of? And what are the potential benefits? And who can this be a wonderful thing for? And it's interesting to explore that, especially as a cardiologist with 20 years of training saying that this would be something that's awful for people to do. But I think hopefully you'll learn a lot today from her balanced approach. We also talk about evolution, and of course we talk about fiber, which is a very misconstrued component as well about how necessary and healthy that is. So I'm sure you'll appreciate Amber's approach. She's very thoughtful. And this is a very interesting field that we don't know a lot about, and we're continuing to learn a lot about from personal experiences and people sharing their very intimate personal experiences like Amber has. So please enjoy this interview with Amber O'Hearn. Amber O'Hearn, thank you so much for joining me on the Diet Doctor Podcast today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a great pleasure.
Well, you are one of these personalities in the low-carb world that just everybody loves. Everybody wants to talk to you. Everybody wants to be around. Everybody wants to hear your story. And you have quite an amazing story that you've been very open and honest about that maybe it sometimes can be difficult to talk about, but for you, it doesn't seem so. And it's a story that involves weight loss and pregnancies, but then also some psychiatric challenges. So give us a brief introduction about your transition into the low-carb world.
Sure. Well, you know, I wasn't always quite as open about it, but over time it's become easier, in part because I think so many people can benefit from hearing what happened to me. So I did used to tell my story primarily as a weight loss story because that's how I started on it. That's how I got into low carb. I don't think I ever would have come to the low carb world if I hadn't been overweight a few times in my life. So the first time that I tried low carb, it was for weight loss. And that was just a regular low-carb diet, and it was back in 1997. And I had tried other things. I had tried exercise. I had tried veganism, and they hadn't helped me with the weight loss. And I finally thought, well, maybe there is something to this low-carb stuff. So I had been on a low-carb diet very successfully for many years. But then, and I do think pregnancy had something to do with it, or maybe aging, but I was gaining weight over time. So I'm 5'6", and I would say my ideal weight is maybe around 130 pounds. And by the time I got to the end of 2008, I guess I was about 35, I weighed almost 200 pounds. I'd actually stopped looking at the scale because it was too depressing.
Right.
But I was doing a low-carb diet, and periodically I would stop because I'd say, what's even the point if I'm continuing to gain weight? But then I would gain weight even faster, and so I would eventually go back on the low-carb diet. It wouldn't take too long. I again was facing a weight loss issue, a weight gain issue, and I found some people talking on the internet about doing what they were calling a zero-carb diet. That name is a little bit confusing because it really has to do with animal foods versus plant foods. And so it was an all-meat diet, no plants included.
And when was this? How long ago?
It was in the end of 2008.
Wow. So that was really early times for that movement or that type
of
diet. Yeah.
There weren't a lot of people talking about it. But the people that were talking about it were people like me who had been on a low-carb diet, had studied some of the low-carb science and were convinced that that was healthy, but it wasn't quite enough for them. And only when they gave up the plants were they able to see the results that they wanted. And I didn't think about it as a kind of lifestyle change. I thought, well, I could do that for a little while and lose this weight maybe if I'm lucky, and then I could just return to my garden variety low-carb diet.
Right.
So I made a plan, and it took me, I would say it took me about 3 weeks to really work myself up to it. And I planned to go on it for 3 weeks and then have a low-carb birthday cake for my birthday. And that birthday cake never came because the results were so great, both for weight loss, but they profoundly affected my mood.
Right.
And so that's why I'm still on a plant-free diet today.
So when you were having your weight challenges, was that when you were also having challenges with bipolar type 2 disorder?
Yes. Yeah. And in fact, if you look back at the timeline of various mood and weight times in my life, the times where I had the worst mood problems were corresponding to the times that I had the biggest weight problems. And it was only recently that I really looked back at that on a timeline bird's eye view and said, oh, these are really pretty deeply connected. So I was diagnosed with major depressive disorder when I was 20 in my first year of university. It was really disruptive. And then I was on antidepressants for a long time. And in my 30s, I was re-diagnosed with a form of bipolar disorder called bipolar type 2. And the difference between that and traditional bipolar 1 is that you don't have the psychotic mania states. So you have the depressive side and you have a milder form of mania called hypomania. And so then I was actually really happy to be diagnosed with that, even though it sounds much scarier, because I thought, oh, this is why I haven't been able to get any real results with my depression treatment, because they're treating the wrong disorder.
Right.
And so I then went on this horrendous ride of a variety of bipolar medications, which never really helped.
Yeah. But then the carnivore diet did help. I mean, is that when you saw the biggest change?
It is. And, you know, it's funny because bipolar and depression can sometimes be slow moving. So if you see yourself having a great mood within a couple of weeks, you don't necessarily think that your bipolar disorder is cured, right? But it also seemed qualitatively different. Another problem with bipolar disorder, and it's a clinical problem, is that people who have bipolar disorder often don't have the self-awareness to know what's going on or when they're in what state. And so I'd kind of learned to distrust my own mind. Oh. And so it took a long time to regain that and to say, yes, I really am better. But I've been med-free for 9 years, unless you count coffee.
I think that counts for something, but not as bad as medicines in this case. So 9 years, that's impressive. Now, you know, people talk about the ketogenic diet as being restrictive, in air quotes, and those who are in it obviously know it's not restrictive. But then you talk about the carnivore diet. And the people in the keto community, some will call it the carnivore diet restrictive and crazy. And for you to be doing it for so long, did you have sort of part of this cognitive dissonance, like I'm feeling better, but I'm not supposed to be doing this and maybe I'm doing something wrong? Have you been wrestling with that?
Well, maybe for a very short time. As far as the feeling of restriction, I mean, obviously it is more restricted just from a technical standpoint.
Right.
But the feeling of restriction is actually, I think, a lot less. For one thing, when you're not eating anything that has any trace of sweetness in it, the cravings for sweet and for other foods really go away. I think even when you're on a ketogenic diet, you can see this, right? If you go, you're in the bakery and you walk past those cakes with the blue icing and you say, does that even register as food? Probably not, right?
Right. Makes you more nauseous than craving.
Right. So when I walk through the produce section, I wouldn't say it makes me nauseated, but it's like pretty flowers or something. So I don't feel restricted. And I also don't have to try to eat a certain amount the way that even sometimes in ketogenic diets you do. You have maybe a protein restriction, and that might make your ability to eat meals a little more restricted.
Very interesting. Now, why do you think this works? I mean, I know it's such a fascinating Wild West field that we don't have science or data on this necessarily to say this is what works and why. So is it because it's an elimination diet? Is it because there's something beneficial about that much meat? Is it because of a gut imbalance? I mean, can you think of what, and you've obviously done a lot of research into this and you approach things from a very intellectual standpoint. So what is your thought that you've come across as to why this has worked for you and for so many others?
It's really the million-dollar question, but yeah. I've had a lot of time to think about it and my thinking about it has changed over the years. So when I started, you had asked earlier if I felt like maybe I shouldn't be doing it. And everyone tells you that you need to eat vegetables. That's the narrative, even in the ketogenic community. And so at first, when I realized that I felt so well, I thought, I'm feeling better in spite of the fact that I'm not eating vegetables. And it didn't occur to me for a little while to think, well, I'm really feeling better because I'm not eating vegetables, even right. though obviously it has to be that in some way. So one of the first insights that I gained about it was from reading Dr. Georgia Ead, who has written a lot about the fact that we evolved, plants evolved, in order to survive, they had to have a kind of biochemical defense because they can't run away. And so there's been this arms race between herbivores, including insects, and plants, on the other hand, always trying to get this survival. And so it hadn't been until I saw her work that I thought, oh, well, the things that are in plants are actually, many of them are actually toxins. And so maybe that could be part of the problem. One of the great things that I learned this year was I went to visit the clinic in Hungary, the Paleo Medicina Clinic, and they are treating patients with chronic diseases using an all-meat diet, a very ketogenic form of the all-meat diet.
Interesting.
And their theory is completely based on intestinal permeability.
Ah. How long have they been doing that? How long has that clinic been around?
I think it's on the order of 5 years. I'm not sure exactly.
Very interesting.
When I first heard of intestinal permeability, I thought it couldn't possibly apply to me because I'd heard of Cordain's work, and he was talking about the lectins in grains and how they might cause intestinal permeability and then go on to cause autoimmune problems. And so on the one hand, the difference between my feeling better and feeling worse had nothing to do with grains. I already wasn't eating grains.
Right.
And on the other hand, I didn't think of a psychiatric issue as having anything to do with autoimmunity. So I saw those papers and didn't look into them really. But what I didn't realize is that many plants have the ability to cause intestinal permeability. Or on the other hand, if you already have an intestinal permeability issue, then the toxins in plants that might not even be causing it so much on their own can start causing problems that they wouldn't have if you didn't have mm-hmm. intestinal permeability.
Yeah. And that makes it hard because you see so many people eating plants and doing just fine, right? I mean, and most people can tolerate plants just fine. And you say, well, if there are toxins in these plants, why aren't they affecting everybody? And it might have something to do with just pre-existing intestinal permeability or a genetic predisposition. And sort of, you have to sort of think of yourself as a special case, which we don't always want to do. So was that part of it as you? I'm different. I don't want to be different, but I am?
Yes. Yes. I mean, you're absolutely right about seeing individuals who are able to eat plants. It's a little bit like in the low-carb world, we see, for example, modern hunter-gatherer societies that have a higher carb intake and don't have any signs of metabolic syndrome, diabetes, or heart disease. And so we say, well, there you go, carbs can't cause a problem. But I think that you get to a certain point where you have a certain amount of disorder, and now you're no longer able to eat those carbs and still be healthy. Yeah. And so I think there's a parallel kind of situation where if you have a certain, maybe it's an intestinal permeability issue, and maybe it's something else, but you've gotten to a point where the plants are no longer safe.
Right. Right. So the Katavans are sort of the classic example of a high carbohydrate diet, but yet relatively healthy when we talk about the chronic diseases and the diseases that we're fighting now, presumably due to carbohydrates. But the same thing can be said about the blue zone populations, that they eat their whole grains and their fruits and their vegetables, but you have to factor it into their whole lifestyle and how they live their life with their relaxation and their connection and their exercise and what the other quality of their food are that they're eating and possibly even their genetics. So they're going to be a separate subset, and we can't assume that we're all the same, that we're all going to be like that. So you made this transition years ago. And I mean, would you ever think of going back?
Well, honestly, I don't really like to play around with it much because the consequences are so severe.
Yeah.
I've had a couple of situations where something that I had added to my diet, be it a supplement, I don't normally use much supplements, but I've tried things here and there. And I've ended up lying on my bed looking up at the ceiling, wishing I was dead, and thinking, oh, wait a second. I've been here before.
That's dramatic.
It really is. And so from that standpoint, it's not something that I've been eagerly trying to test things out and see if I can reintroduce them. I'm also pretty satisfied with my lifestyle. As I said before, you know, the cravings disappear and beef and other meats are quite satiating. but that said, you know, if I learned something new, I try to really keep an open mind, and I'm not at all averse to the idea of learning more and finding myself somewhere different 10 years from now than I expected to be.
Yeah, so one of the most interesting concepts, I think, when thinking about a carnivore diet is thinking of it as a short-term intervention to fix something versus a long-term lifestyle and the difference between those. So as an example is, you know, you do it short-term, it's an elimination diet, and then as you're feeling better, you slowly start adding things in, like just some spinach or just some broccoli or just some cauliflower or whatever the case may be, until you find something that's a trigger so that you can start experiencing and enjoying vegetables and find out what you can and can't eat, or just say, look, I'm feeling better, I'm sticking with it. So I think the main question is there a danger? Is there a risk? And obviously we don't know the answer to that question. And that's the other $1 million question.
I'm sorry, is your question, is there a risk to adding things back, or is there a risk to not adding things back?
Is there a risk to staying carnivore long term?
Uh-huh.
Right, I think that's the main question. The risk to adding things back, you will notice, because if you went carnivore for a reason and something improved and you start adding things back and you feel those again, then you know you can't add those back. Because the way I think of carnivore is it's a great intervention to try and fix something, change something. But then I want to get people back to a variety of vegetables. Now, why do I feel that way? Because, again, because I've been ingrained for decades that this is not necessarily a healthy long-term option. Do I have any data to say that? Do I know that for sure? I don't. But that it's, you know, it's hard to overcome some of those personal beliefs. And yet here you are 10 years later, obviously doing just fine. So do you have any concerns for long-term health or sustainability for you?
Well, I would want to answer that a couple of ways. One is, would you say the same thing for a low-carb diet?
Right.
Would you say, well, it's a good short-term intervention, but eventually I'll want to see people adding back potatoes and grains so they can get back to a regular diet. And
I would not. Yeah.
But of course, we do have a lot more data for the low-carb situation, but it wasn't too long ago that we had a lot less data, and we had to kind of go with our gut feeling of this is creating a better health situation for you, so why mess with it?
Right.
The other thing that I would bring up is the more recent societies that we have in the recent past that have been living on very low plant diets. So for example, the Inuit, although their diet is quite different in terms of things like their polyunsaturated fatty acids, the Maasai are often brought up, the Mongolians, who at least before the introduction of wheat lived for a very long time. They had two words for food. There was red food and white food, and that was meat and dairy. And they basically didn't eat plants either, and they were not known for their wimpiness. So
yeah.
I think we at least have some reasons to believe that it could be quite sustainable.
Yeah, it's interesting. So with the Inuit, some people say they ate sea vegetables and berries, and with the Maasai, they traded for bananas and other. So I guess there's an argument there if it was truly 100%. Does it matter if it's 1% versus 100%? I mean, it's still a very low amount. But interestingly, I think that a lot of the people who will say that there's no evolutionary or population base who's done this as a comparison are sort of the vegans. And you can say the same thing about vegans. There's been no society that's existed as vegan. But yet somehow that seems more acceptable among the general population than the carnivore. The carnivore movement seems to have created much more of an uproar, again, because of our dietary guidelines and sort of where we've come from and what we think are healthy. But it comes down, when the question comes down to nutrient deficiencies. So with a vegan diet, which is a very restrictive diet, it's well accepted that there are nutrient deficiencies and you need to supplement with B12 and omega-3s and maybe vitamin D and others. So with a carnivore diet, there's the same concern, magnesium and selenium and a number of others. So do you find that you do supplement or that you would recommend people supplement if they're on a carnivore diet?
I don't supplement, and I hate to use the word traditional, but I've been in this space for a while. The traditional wisdom among the carnivores that I know is that supplementation usually leads to more problems than it solves.
Interesting.
One of the things that's really interesting about nutrient deficiencies in a carnivore diet is that a carnivore diet is also a ketogenic diet, if only mildly so. And as one of the speakers at the conference here was saying today, when you're in a ketogenic state, a whole host of metabolic pathways become different. And what vitamins are technically are enzymes for metabolic processes, or coenzymes, I should say. And so if you're using a whole host of different metabolic pathways, it shouldn't be a surprise that some of those coenzymatic needs are going to change in their levels. And so in some ways, I think we are back at the beginning. The RDAs are all based on high-carb dieters,
right.
And there's so many different factors. For example, there are absorption factors. If you're eating grains or legumes, then you're going to need a higher level of zinc than if you're not, because there are phytates, for example, that interfere with the absorption of zinc to a very large degree. And so if you remove all the plants from your diet, all of a sudden the balance of nutrients is going to change in ways that we can't necessarily predict.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So all the RDAs, all the assumptions about what we need and we don't need are for a grain-based type of diet or a high-carbohydrate type of diet. So this changes that dramatically. So it really is sort of a period of unknown, though, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
It's fun and of course, not without risk.
Right. And then, but one of the other concepts, when you compare it to evolutionary societies, is they ate differently even from a carnivore standpoint. They ate nose to tail. They ate organ meats. They made use of the whole animal. And I don't know about you personally, but a lot of people in the carnivore community eat, you know, sirloin steaks and ground beef, and that's it, more of the muscle meat. Do you have concerns from that standpoint? Do you think it should be more varied, or even adding fish and eggs into that as well?
Well, I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit. How do you know that during our evolution we were eating nose to tail?
I guess, you know what? That's a great point. That's an assumption, because when you had a kill, you know, you didn't know when your next one was going to be. And we've been taught that they made the most use of that animal and they ate all of it. I don't know any science that proves that or not. That's just sort of the assumption, I guess, isn't it?
It's a little bit difficult to know. I'm not totally objecting to the idea that we might have. And certainly if you were in a time of less abundance, you wouldn't want to throw anything away that you could use.
Right.
But even if you look at our use of plants, we don't eat, you know, we don't eat the rinds necessarily. And we were also, at least in certain times, possibly competing with other carnivores who might have, for example, gotten to the carcass first. So if we were scavengers at one point, we might have been eating a whole different set of part of the body than the whole.
Right.
There are also anecdotes from Stephenson, for example, that the Inuit weren't eating the whole animal, that they were sharing a lot with their dogs and they would preferentially give organs.
Hmm.
Now, on the other side of the coin, we know that organs tend to be high in certain nutrients that are important,
right.
Critical for the brain, in fact. So some people argue that you should be eating the liver and you should be eating the brain. And I feel I have to be a bit agnostic at this point. I eat organs myself because I like them, but I'm not really sure what the true importance of them is.
And what about, you mentioned the Inuit, so what about the Maasai and modern hunter-gatherer societies? Do they, you know, we can still see how they eat. Do they tend to eat nose to tail?
You know, that's an excellent question that I haven't looked into for the Maasai. What I know about the Maasai is that they mostly eat blood and milk.
Yeah.
And they're keeping the animals alive, and that would suggest that they don't get a lot of access to the organs, but I imagine that at some point they probably do eat them.
Okay. And then what about the absolute amount of protein? So in a ketogenic diet, there's a lot of controversy about protein. And it seems, yeah, right? The more, to oversimplify it, the risk of oversimplifying it, the more insulin resistant you are, sort of the less protein you can have to remain in ketosis, and the more insulin sensitive you are, the more protein you can have to stay in ketosis, I think is a relatively fair oversimplification. But then when you go to carnivore, your protein levels go up dramatically. Is there a concern of too much protein, not only from a ketone standpoint, but from an overstimulation of mTOR and growth pathways and potential IGF-1 cancer risk down the road, because that's something that's been talked about and examined quite a bit as well.
I really like the way you articulated that, because I do think that a lot of it depends on your insulin damage state. And so I know that some people in the keto world and even in the carnivore world seem to do better on less protein. But it's not all about ketogenesis in the carnivore world, which was really surprising to me, actually, because a lot of the benefits seem to come just from the abstinence from plants. And so there are people who I think eat so much protein on a carnivorous diet that they're in very mild ketosis or maybe more infrequent ketosis, and yet they still seem to be getting the full benefit of that. So, for example, you could imagine that someone whose reason for being carnivore is that they have irritable bowel disease, they wouldn't necessarily have an insulin problem, and so they wouldn't have as much therapeutic need for ketosis. The other idea, though, that I would like to bring up is that maybe using a glucose-based system that's on demand when you need it to be made from your liver is still a much healthier state than bringing in exogenous carbohydrates. So that you're always on this kind of, oh, I've got too much, oh, I've got too little, and having to adjust to the outside intake. If you're eating protein, most of your metabolic processes are still being predominantly glucose. If that's coming from gluconeogenesis, that still might be a healthier state than being on a high-carb diet where you're always having these blood sugar swings.
Yeah, that's a good point. Where your glucose comes from matters, for sure. So you've mentioned a couple things. I mean, we obviously talked about you in specific. So there was weight loss and psychiatric effects. And you mentioned irritable bowel or even inflammatory bowel. It seems like there is a certain autoimmune component to what a carnivore diet can benefit. So would that sort of be your go-to if somebody said, who do you recommend does this? Would autoimmunity sort of top the list for you?
Absolutely. Autoimmunity is the number one place where I've seen anecdotes. And it's not just that the carnivore diet has had a lot of good results in those diseases, but those diseases have no other place to go.
That's a great point.
So why not try it?
So whether it's Michaela Peterson with her horrible autoimmune arthritis that got better, or whether it's people, have you heard, you know, is it thyroid disease improves, whether it's Hashimoto's thyroiditis or other inflammatory bowel conditions. And I mean, what's the examples that you've seen of people who have had dramatic improvements?
Asthma, Lyme disease, allergies even, for autoimmune. And obviously Crohn's.
Mm-hmm.
Then mood disorders is the second one that I would bring up. And I don't know if that's because mood disorders actually have an underlying autoimmune component that we don't know about. There is a theory, I don't remember what it's called, but it has to do with permeability of the blood-brain barrier. Mm. So if you imagine that there's intestinal permeability that's affecting your immune system, and you've got that compromised, so you have now agents that shouldn't be in your bloodstream, and if you also have a permeability problem in your brain barrier, then that could also have a similar kind of consequence. Mm. But regardless of mechanism, we have found, at least anecdotally, that there are people like me who have either bipolar disorder, anxiety disorder, depressive disorder. I haven't heard anecdotes about schizophrenia, but I have a high level of suspicion that it could be helpful for those people as well.
Yeah, and like you said, what other options exist? And schizophrenia is one that not a lot of great options exist for them to be, you know, functional and feeling better off medications with side effects. I mean, that's a very big challenge. So if this could serve that role, why not try it?
I don't know if you're familiar with a paper that it was Dr. Westman and somebody else. They had a case study with someone with schizophrenia.
Oh, really?
On a ketogenic diet. And they speculated that the improvement that they saw, which was drastic, by the way, this was an elderly person who had been schizophrenic with severe psychosis their entire life, went on a ketogenic diet and had complete, like, no more hallucinations.
Wow.
They suspected that there might have been a role for gluten and the absence of gluten in that particular case. And so if gluten is a problem, then maybe intestinal permeability is a problem, and maybe a completely carnivorous diet would help people there.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Now, one of the things about ketosis is I generally like people to get into ketosis and try it for at least 30 days, because there is this concept, you don't know what you don't know. Right? You don't know how much better you could feel. You may think you're fine, but maybe you could feel better. Would you take it one step further and say everybody should try carnivore for 30 days because you don't know if maybe you'll feel better? Is that a statement you'd make, or am I putting words in your mouth?
No, there? I absolutely would. You know, it's really funny because people think that they can reason from everything they know about nutrition or biological science and say, I know what the effect of that diet would be, and it's not going to help me.
Yeah.
But they really, if you've been through this process of trying a ketogenic diet and being really amazed at the, you know, half dozen things that happened to you that you didn't expect and that nobody told you you could expect, positive side effects, if you will, the same kind of thing happens on a carnivorous diet. And it's really, it sounds silly saying it, but it really has to be experienced to be believed.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Okay. Let's transition a bit away from the carnivorous diet, because one of your other topics that you've written a lot about and spoken about is evolution. And I've seen a number of papers recently saying that agriculture and grains happened far earlier than we thought they did. So maybe we evolved with grains and not without grains. And then others saying our ancestors were mostly plant-based and we've got it all wrong. And again, it's hard to understand the science because we're talking about something that happened, you know, thousands of years ago. And it's hard to separate science from propaganda, from people just spouting opinion. So what have you learned in this process of studying evolution and trying to figure out the contributions of meat versus plants versus grains?
Well, you know, I think that we probably always had some contribution of plants in our diet, but I think that a lot of the time it was very low. If we narrow down what we're talking about in terms of the period, I like to think about the period from when the Homo genus started a couple million years ago and when our brains started really expanding. The thing about the ability to get the energy that we required in order to feed not just our bodies but our brains, which actually require a whole lot of energy. The more brain tissue you have, the more energy you need because it's a very expensive tissue.
Right.
In order to have been able to get that from grains and tubers, we would have had to have had a consistent supply of them, and we would have had to have had cooking. And there really isn't any evidence that we had the widespread controlled use of fire until maybe 100,000 years ago, which is much later than all this brain expansion took place. And so, you know, I think a lot of people get really excited when they find grains, some grains at a site, and said, see, we had grains back then. But just because we had a few, I mean, obviously we had to have come to it gradually. We didn't just suddenly one day start farming grains. We had to have discovered grains and been using them a little bit and then using them more. There's a great theory that the reason that we wanted to use grains was actually because of the opioid effects because of beer. But that's a bit of a different story.
Yeah.
But whatever led us to be motivated to do grain agriculture was a gradual process. And so it shouldn't be surprising if we find some evidence of some use of grains going farther back than the onset of agriculture.
Yeah. The other thing about evolution, though, is the concept of intermittent fasting, because we didn't always have fresh meat available, right? The kills would be sort of intermittent, theoretically, and so we would have to be fasting for some part of that. Think that should play in? I'm getting back to the carnivore diet now. Do you think because of just saying that was part of evolution that should also be part of the carnivore diet?
It's another one of those things that's hard to say without actually being there, because there's some reason to believe that the abundance of animals was actually quite a bit more at that time. If you compare, for example, there you can look at bone evidence and see how much famine periods that societies went through by looking at there's a marker in the bone that shows fasting periods. And there's actually evidence that agricultural societies had much worse and more frequent famines. And I think that's because they were reliant on this supply that could be, you know, the whole supply could be killed for an entire year.
Mm-hmm. Whereas, one bad hailstorm away from famine, basically.
Exactly. But the other thing to take into account is that the animals that we had access to before agriculture, we had megafauna, and they were much larger, and there were probably a lot more of them. And so you could have one kill that could perhaps last months if you knew how to store it.
Right. That's a good point. So without freezers, though, that would be tricky, but not impossible.
Yeah, there's evidence that we would put them underwater or that we could dry them. I think we really don't know a lot, and there's a lot of debate, though, on what really happened.
Yeah, but people sure like to talk about like they knew what happened, don't they?
Yes.
I find myself falling in the same trap. Like, this is what I've heard. This is what makes sense. So therefore, it must be true. But you bring up a nice perspective that, wait, slow down. Maybe we need to think about this differently.
Well, I'm certainly susceptible to it myself.
Yeah. All right. Now, another quick transition into fiber, because we hear a lot about healthy fiber, that we all need our fiber, and the gut microbiome. We need to feed the microbiome with fibers so that they get their short-chain fatty acids, and a diverse microbiome is a healthy microbiome. So I guess that's a lot right there to digest.
There is a lot right there to digest.
So let's start with fiber. Why don't you need your fiber? What makes you so special?
Well, I don't think I'm special in that regard, actually. So fiber first came into people's awareness, I think, with Burkitt, where he was comparing some modern hunter-gatherers to Westerners and trying to figure out what was it about their diet that would make them so much healthier. And he noticed that they had more fiber. The particular peoples he was looking at had more fiber in their diets. And so he proposed that as the reason. And I don't think it's really held up to scrutiny. So, for example, one reason that people have latched on to is that, it lowers your blood glucose. Well, that may be true if you're eating a lot of digestible carbohydrates, but it absolutely has no bearing on someone on a low-carb diet. Another reason that I have heard, it can actually fill your gut and thereby cause you to not overeat. And I think that that's, you need to give your body a little bit more credit. if it's not getting the calories it needs, the signal will get there.
Right. So if you're eating a lot of processed foods and high carbohydrate foods, you're not getting the nutrients, you're going to continue to be hungry. And then maybe adding fiber can help in that situation. But if you're already eating satiating foods, then the fiber is not going to serve the same kind of role.
Yes.
Yeah.
But let's talk a little bit about the short chain fatty acid idea.
Yeah.
So one thing that I have learned is that you can get short chain fatty acids whether or not you're eating plant fiber. So, for example, I've seen a study in dogs where they gave them a completely meat-based diet and one that included some plant fibers in it. And the short-chain fatty acids that came out as a result were exactly the same.
Really?
So the gut bacteria will adapt to what you feed it. You don't have to plant gut bacteria in there. You feed them and they will come. And so if you change what you're eating, the gut biome will change very quickly. There will always be those that are producing short-chain fatty acids. But then how important are those short-chain fatty acids? A lot of people point to butyrate in particular and say, this is really important for the health of the colon. I've looked at a lot of the studies on the putative health benefits of butyrate in the colon, and a lot of them seem to come back to this idea of feeding the colonocyte. What happens when you give the butyrate to the colonocyte is that it breaks it down into the metabolite beta-hydroxybutyrate.
Isn't that interesting? We ever heard that before?
Another piece of data that might be interesting is if you look at the literature in germ-free animals. So mouse, for example, that's been brought up without any source of bacteria to fill up their guts. It turns out that they live longer and that they have less fat on their bodies, and for the most part, they're more active, and they certainly don't seem to be compromised by it.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of reasons to think that what we think we know about the gut biome isn't necessarily so.
So one of the arguments, though, is that breast milk has precursors that help your gut biome mature and turn into short chain fatty acids and make it more diverse, which is a healthier microbiome.
Well, hold on now.
Okay.
The only place that I've seen that's a source of the idea that a more diverse gut biome is healthier was a comparison with the Hadza.
Right. So maybe I'm confusing my evidence here, because that's the Hadza definitely said that they were more diverse compared to the industrial societies with mm-hmm. completely different diets. So, okay, scratch that one from the record. Scratch the more diverse, but that it's important for the development of the microbiome. So with the breast milk. So would you say that that's a short-term need, and once it's developed, then longer-term, you don't need the same precursors as more?
I just don't think that we know.
Yeah.
I think that the gut is extremely important, and I wouldn't want to be understood as saying that I didn't think that the gut health is important, but I just think that manipulating it from the outside might not be the best way to do that.
Yeah.
And another reason that we might think we need gut bacteria is because some people who have taken prebiotics have said that it's helped them with digestive problems.
Right.
And my answer to that is, if you're trying to digest something that you need certain bacteria to be able to digest it, then feeding prebiotics that help that strain grow might be useful. But if you're not eating cabbage, then why do you need the bacteria in sauerkraut, I guess is the point. If you don't need those particular bacteria because you're not trying to digest those particular foods.
Yeah, very good points. Now, do you follow yourself with labs? Are you a N-of-1 tester, or do you want to make sure that there aren't any signs of deleterious effects down the road?
I'm terribly behind in this project. It's not that I don't think it's important, but the last labs that I got were 5 years ago.
Oh, interesting.
So I actually have some labs lined up. I had ordered some this summer, and they fell through. They were all lost by the by the company that took them,
oh, no.
So I need to do them again. But I'm really interested in that kind of data. It just hasn't been a priority.
Yeah, because when it comes to sort of the general population understanding what a carnivore diet is and what it can represent and how it can change things, a big example is Dr. Sean Baker. And as much as amazing as he is, that's what makes him such a terrible example, because he's such a high-end athlete setting world records, and his energy demands are off the charts. So I think to try and use his labs and say this is what can happen on a carnivore diet is not such a great example. And that's where people like you and the more, you know, less extreme person on a carnivore diet would be very helpful. Are there communities where people are sharing their labs or sharing, you know, especially their hemoglobin A1C and their CRPs and their lipids and so forth about what happens?
In carnivores?
Yeah, in carnivores.
Not that I know of. It could be happening.
Okay. I think that would be very interesting. Well, if you do get your labs and you want to share them, that would be wonderful.
Sure, I'd love to.
Yeah, so I mean, there's so much that we don't know, but I think it's clear what we do know is that this can be helpful for a number of people. And I like your perspective on when there's not many other alternatives, the potential risks seem a lot smaller. I think that's a very good way to look at it.
Yeah, and you know, the risks, as far as I know at this point, are theoretical,
right.
Really.
Very theoretical.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, Amber, thank you so much for coming on today to have this discussion. Any last words, and where can people learn more about you? Because I know you have a lot of material online that can be very helpful for some people.
Thank you for asking. I can be followed on Twitter. My handle is Keto Carnivore, and I'm very open to answering questions as best as I can. I have two blogs. One of them, it's a kind of a funny historical story. I made two blogs because I was so averse to talking about this carnivore idea that I didn't want to put it on my main blog, which was about the science of ketogenic diets. So I've written some articles about ketogenic diets, and that's on ketotic.org. And then I started writing more personal experiences about the carnivore diet on mpiri.ca.
Why were you averse to talking about it?
Because it felt so unscientific. I couldn't bring to bear a clinical trial. All I could say was, this is what I'm doing and this is what's happening. And I was very uncomfortable with mixing that up with the other site, which I really wanted to present as, this is what the literature shows. In retrospect, I think that was maybe a bit more fractured than I needed to be.
Well, but I think that says a lot for your integrity, both your scientific integrity and just as a person, that you don't want to represent something as being something that it's not, certainly with level of evidence. So I appreciate that. And I think that's important for everything, for people to understand where it's N of one, where it's N of many, and where it's scientific trials. They're all valuable, but we need to interpret those differently. So I think it's great that you did that. Yeah.
Thank you.
Very good. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on today. I really appreciate it.